rolling. And we're back with another episode of Panoramic Outdoors. Here today we got...
Panoramic Outdoors.
Can't do anything without catching heat on this platform.
But I'm back.
Sheldon's like back.
Episode number 1700 that I've missed now.
Welcome back.
Where were you?
Working.
Yeah, we explained where you were. How was that?
It was good. It was a learning experience, that's for sure. We had men and women from all over the country and all over, not all over, but a lot of the states brought some men and equipment up, or people and equipment up, to help us out. And yeah, it was a process and it was a huge learning curve for, I think, anybody that was involved in that storm. But yeah.
Big collaboration.
It was huge.
Yeah.
So Canadians came together to really help Manitoba out here and get the hydro put back on for people across Manitoba.
Yeah, absolutely. Like my job with hydro right now is like, I look after contracts. So anybody that contracts with us, I kind of look after that side of things. So I had to deal with like, companies that came into our province, not knowing our standards or our lingo and stuff like that, and try to, you know, jump those hurdles with them to make sure we're doing the same work. And, I worked with like, a group from, Minnesota, I believe, a couple groups from BC and Alberta. So It was an eye-opening experience.
Wild. Well, thanks for doing that, man. Like, we weren't personally affected here by the snowstorm. We'll say a couple of our trees went down, but that's about it. But I'm sure there's lots of people across Manitoba really appreciate the extra hours everyone was putting in.
Got to say, sometimes you take it for granted being able to just come in, flip that light switch on, or turn up the thermostat a couple degrees.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And not even have to think about it. So, it's,
But yeah, I'd like to say thanks to all the people that have done work with Hydro, and yeah, I'm pretty proud of being a part of that company when we get together and can get stuff done in the crappy weather and being away from family and friends for some guys from like 10 days, some guys were like close to 25, 30 days by the time we got it all cleaned up. So yeah, big props to everyone involved.
I know you won't say it because you're a modest dude, but like, hydro is like something that we might take for granted in this province, just because, like Chase was saying, you know, rates are affordable, the service is always reliable, and it's one thing to have electricity in Canada, but it's another thing to have that utility delivered in a manner that is, you know, consistent and one that, you know, takes seriously its duty to the public. So like, it's awesome that, you know, I just, the more we talk about it, the more I come to appreciate the work that everyone does there and how great of a service that is.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's some risky stuff once in a while too. Like when the lights go out, man, in the middle of a storm, you guys are out there pretty much as soon as you get the call. I'm sure you have some guidelines that you have to follow for safety reasons, but pouring rain or whatever it is, you know,
yeah,
there'll be guys hanging off the pole trying to fix it. So
yeah, you're right.
Who we got on the show today?
Oh my god, what a guest we have today. I was super pumped. He's actually, but I noticed that he was in our province doing some deer hunting, so I just reached out to him and said, hey man, do you want to do a podcast while you're here? And it didn't work out because his timing, but got him on through Skype, and his name's Joe Apple. Is that right? How you say it?
Yep. And so Joe runs a show on the Wild TV network called Edge TV. Yep. And, was a former CFLer and transitioned now into the host of a hunting show. So it's just really exciting to get someone that seems to understand what it's like to try and share the good word and just as enthusiastic about the outdoors as we are.
Yeah, he's got a little depth in the actual program Wild TV too. He's does some of the marketing side of things there, right? And
both sides of the camera.
Yeah, so he's quite an interesting fellow, and he certainly has an interesting story to share with the hunt that he went on in the hills there and stuff, or the ducks. So
and his first ever podcast, and we get to write that down in
ding,
the history
ding,
book.
Ding 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 ding. That's awesome. Yeah, I was a little nervous, eh? Like our first TV celebrity on the show. So,
and he stood up for hunting in the outdoors before on a national scale.
Yeah.
So it's it was awesome to have him on.
Yeah.
Just a solid dude.
Yeah. I might as well just get right into it. I think it's a good episode, and yeah.
Hope you enjoy.
Fired up. So today we're sitting down, and we got a great guest on the other line. Played CFL football in Canada here as an offensive lineman for the Toronto Argonauts. I think you won a Grey Cup as well. Is that true,
Joe? Yes, sir. 2012, we won the 100th Grey Cup.
No big deal. now kind of went from professional football player to hunting. I don't know if I want to say profession, but into a hunting career, I guess, in a way. But yeah, welcome to the show, Joe Apple.
Hey guys, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here, and yeah, looking forward to chat with you guys.
Awesome. Yes, we're happy to have you too. We're glad we could link up with you.
Do you have anything to say to us, Joe, here, maybe after a certain Grey Cup that just occurred? Like maybe a little congratulations, Winnipeg.
No, absolutely congratulations, Winnipeg. A few of my old teammates were actually on the team. So it was great to see those guys get out there and get their name on the cup again. Zach Kalaros.
Oh, that's
you
awesome.
Guys may or may not know, but yeah. He was one of our quarterbacks.
Yeah.
Back in the day, phenomenal guy. Mike O'Shea was actually our special teams coordinator at the time. Cool. Phenomenal coach, one of the most driven, passionate players and coaches I've ever been around. And then also Chad Rempel, their long snapper. Again, just phenomenal guys. They had a solid locker room. So it's nice to see a team like that pull out a win. I was excited. I mean, I've played in the CFL, played for Toronto Argonauts, but I'm not exactly tied to one team with my loyalty. I like to see my old teammates do well.
That's cool to hear that personal connection for sure. Yeah.
Do you still touch base with those, with lots of your old teammates?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, when you get put into those types of situations and you're basically going on the field as a modern day gladiator, you go through situations that bond guys for life.
Yeah.
And there's definitely a few guys that we keep in touch with more than others, but you still touch base regardless every now and then.
Yeah. And I guess I'm sure the camaraderie after winning a Grey Cup too probably strengthens the bond.
Oh, it strengthens the bond and shaves a few years off your life.
That's got to be the largest trophy night celebration I've seen in Winnipeg in a long time.
Yeah. Oh yeah, those guys did a great job of celebrating. They did it. They did the Grey Cup, you know, justice the way they celebrated. That's how it's supposed to be done. They had fun. They earned it, and the city was definitely behind them in the celebration too. It was a lot of fun watching.
Yeah, you bet. So just to get started here, I guess we'll try to get some of our people that follow us to get familiar with you. We'll go with the 5 burning questions. We do this with all of our guests, and it's just kind of fun to get to lighten it up a little bit.
Alrighty.
If you had one last concert to go to, who would you be watching?
Oh, one last concert. I've been to so many great concerts. When I was living in Toronto, we went up so many. I would say Garth Brooks. Garth Brooks is always great.
The Show.
That would be a good one, actually.
Yeah. Big energy there.
Not Chris Gaines, mm-hmm. Garth Brooks.
Yeah, Chris Gaines, no. Garth Brooks, for sure.
Okay, the other question, football player kind of turning to the outdoors, but if you weren't doing your outdoor activities and stuff of that, what would you be doing after football?
You know, my original passion in life was carpentry. I just loved building furniture, building structures. So that was my original game plan in life, was to be a carpenter here in Squamish, my small town I grew up in. Then sports got in the way of that and messed up my plans. But
right on. Being a carpenter too, I guess, what are you like 6'8"? You could do the roofing without ladders and stuff. I'd probably be an advantage.
I'd be setting up all the trusses and doing all of that.
The shoulder pressure trusses up there.
Drywall gets me, man. Every time the drywall, but I guess that's more contracting and stuff like that. Oh
yeah, no, I wouldn't want to be messing with drywall. That's not a fun job. No.
Yeah.
What about dogs or cats?
Dogs or dogs?
Dogs. Do you got any dogs?
100%. I have a beautiful Italian Mastiff named Zoe.
Oh, nice.
She's a great pup. And the missus has actually been bugging me. She wants us to get another puppy or a cat for the dog. And
oh, yeah.
I mean, I'm leaning very heavily towards another dog.
Yeah. Have you ever hunted over dogs, like bird hunting or anything like that?
Sorry, what was that?
Have you ever like bird hunted with dogs and that kind of avenue of the hunting world?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. When I was in Ontario, we went out with a lot of bird dogs. And they're great. They're phenomenal dogs. I've always gone towards more of a bully breed, so a mastiff or a pit bull. But I think I would definitely be open with my next dog to looking into some type of retriever.
Right on. If you had one dream hunt or fishing trip in the next little, let's say in the next 5 years, where would it be? What would you do?
Dream hunt or fishing trip? I would definitely have to say it'd be a hunt. I've always wanted to do a fly-in large game hunt in northern BC or Alaska. Probably moose, a moose or caribou for sure.
Yeah, I'd be like, I think that's on everyone's list at this table too.
Yeah. Thanks for the invite, Joe. We'll be there.
Yeah. That's what we did. We just planned that. That's what
that was, right? Going in the calendar.
And the last question here, if you're lost in the woods with one person, like alive or gone, who would it be and why?
Ooh. So any, I can pick anybody?
You can pick anybody. You can pick Bear Grylls if you want.
I'd have to say, you said that's still with us or who has passed.
That's right.
Yeah. I would go back to my father. Definitely my father.
So is your father around still? Is that why you asked? Or
no, he passed just over 5 years ago from brain cancer, unfortunately. But he was the one who introduced me to hunting, and that was always our big exciting time when we got to go hunting with Dad. So I think, I mean, obviously an opportunity to go back in the bush with him, I'd take that for sure.
I think us, everyone here, even if that meant that you were lost in the bush with him, eh?
Oh, absolutely. It'd be a blast.
Yeah.
And I know he'd be able to figure it out.
So. Yeah. I think that's all we all got our start around the table here was being in the bush with Dad. So I think we can definitely relate to the stories and the memories that emerge from that.
Oh, yeah. They'll last a lifetime.
That's right. That's what it's all about sometimes, right? So I guess that was kind of our five burning questions or fast round or whatever you want to go with.
But you made it.
I survived. Sweating a bit over here, but made it.
Right on. So I guess basically we'll start it off. Do you want to maybe just run through who you are and what you're doing now? Like we've kind of briefly touched on your football time and career, but what are you doing now? Like what are you spending your time doing?
I spend my time running around in the wilderness over here, primarily in British Columbia. But every now and then the network's kind enough to send me to another province and go on some fun hunts. I'm the newest co-host on the show The Edge on Wild TV. Steve Eklund and Eric Reiber were kind enough to let me join them on the team. I'm going out doing a lot of large game hunt here in BC. Aside from that, I also do some work with the network with regards to commercial campaigns and things like that as well.
Right, are you an executive on Wild TV? Is that right?
Yes, an account executive. So I work with a lot of our larger partners and sponsors and help them build and design their commercial campaigns, be it product placement and shows, regular commercial campaigns, all the way up to weekend film shows for people and stuff. So we have a lot of fun. We get to be really creative in the job, which keeps it exciting. And I get to work with the coolest people as well, because I don't care what other people say, the hunting fishing industry is filled with the best salt of the earth people you'll ever meet. So, you know, when you get to go to work every day and deal with those people, it's a pretty cool treat,
man. Like, we're gonna have to agree with you there, because we're still early in our like kind of media careers here ourselves, and we've taken more of the audio route than you, but for sure, we've just had some amazing guests, and everyone we talk to is just more than eager to share with us and like relate and pass on those stories. So we'll reinforce that. I'm wondering though, like what is the kind of like driving force behind the Edge TV show here, and like what's the message that you're trying to get across as, you know, as a host of that?
As a host myself, my primary message, I mean, what drives me as a hunter is I hunt for food acquisition. raised in a small town. My father was a welder for BC Rail, and sometimes the railway wasn't doing the best. So, you know, that's how we put food on our tables. That's what I was raised doing. I go out, I pick wild mushrooms, I forage for all like pine mushrooms, chanterelles, lion's mane, whatever it be. And just, I control the whole process from harvesting the animal to putting it on the plate. I pride myself in doing a good job with that and kind of being a positive representation of the hunting industry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are trying to attack us right now.
Yeah.
And it normally comes from a lack of education, and misrepresentation of us in the media. And I think the majority of individuals who are involved in hunting do it for all the right reasons.
Right.
And they do a really good job, but there's a few bad people in every crowd. And, those other people are trying to leverage that bad side of things. So, yeah, for me, the biggest driver, like I said, is putting food on the table. I love challenging myself. I love going after new adventures, new hunts. After I retired from football, hunting was always my other major passion in life. So I've been fortunate enough to be given an opportunity to pursue that as a career. And yeah, just getting out in the bush and pushing myself in ways that, you know, now that I'm done with sports, I got to find something that pushes me to those limits. And I think, you know, as individuals, as hunters, we find so much out about ourselves, about our limits, about, you know, mentally, physically, when you're in the bush. So that's kind of my main driver. It's so just being out there, being a positive representative of the industry.
You started with this real personal connection to the land, and that's something that you really just want to showcase and share for people as an education opportunity here. And you're trying to move us away from these, maybe some of the negative ambassadors in the sport, you know, like you said, few and far between, but really just showing the positive aspects of like what it means to be connected to the land and the heritage that came out of. Is that fair?
That's very fair. You're much better with your words than I am. I might have to hire you to come around with me and film all my shows with me.
You know what? I had Lan Tawney give me the same compliment, so I'll take it, Joe. But, you know, it's good to hear that, you know, there's a lot of like-minded individuals in the business, and that we got persons like yourselves that, you know, are motivated to take that on. I also like hearing you say how hunting pushes you to the next limit, because like I found myself, and I Sheldon Chase, I don't know if you guys have the same experience, but you know, 40 miles, 30 miles back in the bush, and you're looking at your GPS trying to figure out how the hell you got back here, but you realize you wouldn't be back here unless you were chasing an elk or a moose or some, you know, even a wounded goose for that matter or something, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. It's always looking at that next ridge. No matter how far you go, you always know in the back of your mind, whatever's over that next ridge is where you want to be.
Looks pretty elky over that ridge.
Yeah, that's always a driving force, man, too. And that's when I was guiding, that was like part of the thing that messed me up good, because like we'd take these guys out and then we'd always be looking for the next best spot. So when I came back to hunt it myself, it was like you sit in the tree stand or something. You'd be like, oh, there's got to be a better spot around here.
Yeah.
Over the next ridge.
Yeah.
I just want to jump back there, Joe. You said that on your show you got asked by, was it Eric Greiba and Steve Beckland?
Yes.
So how did you guys know each other before? Like, how did that relationship all start?
That's actually kind of funny how it all came around. Eric and I knew each other. We just linked up through the hunting scene in Ontario. When I was playing for the Argonauts, I was living out there, and I think it was just on social media. I did some posts about being out bird hunting. And Eric reached out to me. He's got Apex Waterfowling, and I can't even remember the name of his bird call company right now. Anyways, he's got a great bird call company as well. So they brought me on, I guess, as a bit of an ambassador for them at the time. And we just kept in touch over the years. And then with Steve Eklund, him and I have a bit of a connection. I never actually met him before coming onto the show, but a few years ago, he came under fire for a cougar hunt he went on.
Yeah.
And it kind of blew up and got really big, tons of negative publicity for him. And again, going back to a lack of education on what was actually going on. But at the time I was living in Toronto and I was doing a lot of PR work for the Toronto Argonauts. So I knew the local news reporters, and they called me in, and I actually went on live TV news. It was CBC.
Yeah, it was CBC. Canada. I was going to say I watched that actually. Like a week ago, I watched it. I was looking for videos of you and like finding stuff. And I'm like, oh man, you did a CBC thing with Bolt Cougars. So I watched that. And that was pretty good.
What was the rundown there?
I just went on and basically defended hunters and defended Steve. on live TV, and you want to talk about getting a lot of death threats and some fun stuff. I mean,
oh yeah,
that was an interesting journey, but I had an opportunity to kind of, again, go up there and defend the reputation of hunters and do a better job educating individuals to what actually goes into these hound hunts. And the main argument was that everybody thought Steve was just trophy hunting, but when he posted the picture of the cougar, the next picture was an image of the stir fry that he made with the cougar meat. So, it was just a good opportunity to get up there and kind of defend hunters and shed some light on the real facts behind the pictures. So Steve and I had that connection. Eric and I had the separate connection. And then Ryan Kohler and the team at Wild TV just kind of threw us all together. And yeah, it's worked really well. The guys were a ton of fun. I haven't had an opportunity to hunt with Steve yet. I've been at a lot of different events with him, but Eric and I have hunted together. And we're all very like-minded, very passionate about, you know, representing the hunting industry properly.
Being true ambassadors.
Oh, go ahead.
Being true ambassadors of sorts.
We try to.
Yeah, okay.
You know, you don't want to make it too serious.
Yeah,
you got to make sure that people understand that you can still have fun and you know, enjoy yourselves out there. I mean, that's the best part about hunting is just the whole experience, the laughs with the guys at camp and all of that as well.
And we can relate to, like, I don't want to say relate, but we feel like the gripping grins get a bad kind of shot on social media because they, you know, they represent all the work we talked about earlier in another podcast, all the work that goes into actually harvesting that animal, but it's only captured in a snapshot. So like, I think the hunters understand that we need to do a better job educating everyone else about why it looks like we're happy in those scenarios because of all the work. What was it like being like stepping up into that kind of role though, to like defend hunting on the public eye? Like, what was going on for you, like, personally inside when you were stepping into that lens?
For me, I kind of eased into that over the years because I was open about the fact that I was a sportsman, that I hunted while I was playing professional football. So I did deal with quite a bit of backlash over the years on a much smaller scale, just in, like, they were attacking me individually. But going on national news and defending hunters as a whole, it didn't really hit me until I was in the studio and getting mic'd up and looking at the desk, being ready to walk over and sit down and do the interview. I realized that you're on such a large scale and there's so many people watching and there's so many people at home counting on you to do a good job representing hunters. If I had kind of went too far one way or miscommunicated something, it could have completely blown up in my face. So it was very unnerving at times, but I had a lot of great people that I called before I went on and got a lot of information, fact checked everything I wanted to talk about. So it went well, but it was definitely, I had a few moments where it was just, you almost feel like a deer in the headlights. You're just so nervous and you want to make sure you represent everybody so well.
Yeah, I watched that interview on YouTube, and yeah, applaud you for going, you know, on CBC and making some statements there as well. And I think that, just like you said on that interview, it's just like the education part of it. And I know I've had the same conversation around campfires in my own camps where people are like, oh, well, why would you ever want to go cougar hunting? And, you know, it's so easy. And it's like, nah, it's not so easy. I mean, like,
no.
And just like with any other show or whatever, the highlight of the show is a guy, say, calling in a 55-inch moose from a mile away, and he shoots it, and everyone's like, well, that's super easy. Well, no, actually, it's not. He spent 10 days out there looking for him first and doing all the work. But the thing is that the highlight of it was something else. And I think that's just one of those things that, in time, it's starting to evolve. And, yeah, like, that whole CBC interview I thought was good. It was a good message. And I would suggest anybody, if they're wanting to listen to it, to just look it up on YouTube. You can find it pretty easy. So.
Right. Yeah, no, there's definitely a big shift in the industry that started towards doing a better job expressing the whole story of a hunt. I definitely think, like you said, media has been designed in a way to relate and communicate strictly from hunter to hunter for so long, that it makes it really easy for people to watch a show and get, if you haven't experienced it yourself, it's really easy to look at it, like you said, and go, oh, wow, you're basically walking in a park and shooting something every time you want to.
Right.
But that's not what real hunting is. Hunting, like you said, is covering vast distances, taping up your blisters, waking up exhausted, tired, malnourished, and then looking at the next mountain and going, okay, that's where I'm going today, and climbing up over that next mountain. And then once you harvest an animal, taking it all the way back and making sure you get every edible ounce of that animal back home and preparing it for your family and loved ones. And I think that's the part of the story that needs to get communicated better moving forward.
So after the like those experiences that you spoke about, and just after that description you gave us, like how have you changed kind of the way you display stuff, say on your social media or through your TV show? How has that changed things for you, or what are you doing anything different to kind of tell more of that whole story?
I try to, you know, you still have that desire to still post your old grip and grin just because you are so proud of that animal and everything that goes into harvesting it. But I've tried to start tailoring my content more towards, like you said, telling the whole story and going away from, you know, the locker room or hunt camp conversations and the posts that you would do there, and think more of what I would post in front of a larger audience.
Right.
And try and bring them in, because also a big goal of mine is to make that general public, the people that don't know where they sit on hunting or how they feel about it, it's trying to at least get them more open-minded towards the idea and understanding what we do and why we do it. So if you can get a few new hunters out of it, I love taking people out hunting who have never been hunting before. Actually, just last night, I helped one of my buddies butcher his own deer for the first time. He had never butchered a deer before.
Nice.
But just helping people kind of become more self-sufficient that way and getting people to be more open-minded to the process. So I try and post it in a more, I guess, inviting way, if you will.
Right. So taking a step back from the grip and grins and displaying the entire process, essentially.
And we don't need to I think what you're hitting on here, Joe, is that we don't need to turn everyone into, you know, someone who's chasing a 180 class buck every year and like putting out 140 trail cams. What we're trying to do is just move the needle a bit here, make people a little bit more comfortable with knowing where their food comes from and knowing what those processes look like, that, you know, that venison isn't going to come on a styrofoam plate per se, right?
No, absolutely. It's just, like you said, just giving people an appreciation of what really goes into the hunting process and understanding the full circle of it. I think it's extremely important. And just, opening up the opportunity for new hunters or people who may have a certain stigma against hunting, just kind of educating them on what's actually I've actually been successful in swinging a few people who weren't, I mean, not like polar anti-hunters. They weren't crazy like that, but they were kind of on the fence or against hunting to an extent. And then when you actually explain the process and tell them how much work goes into it and the fact that you're not just, you know, sitting out there and blasting deer in city parks, whatever it may be, they really appreciate it. And actually one of my friends, his fiance's cousin was a vegan and like hard set in her ways vegan. And he prepared venison for the family one night and he kind of told everybody about the process and she came over and had some venison. No way. And like those type of stories are really cool because there's a lot of alignment in between values, between hunters, ethical hunters, and foragers and people that are vegan or whatever it may be. There's a lot of values that align strongly there. So it's pretty cool when you can create that bridge.
We both want to know where our food comes from and we both want to get that as ethically as possible.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. So like, I guess we got a pretty good rundown on who you are, I guess, in a way. And one of the things that if anybody's kind of wondering how we got connected is the same thing like you're talking about with Eric and with Steve, is that social media kind of got you guys together. And that's what happened here. You were in Manitoba doing a whitetail hunt in the Duck Mountains. Is that right?
Yes.
So then I actually,
unbelievable.
Yeah, I sent you a message like kind of like, hey, welcome to Manitoba. If you have time, let's do a podcast. And right away you're like, bang. You're like, yeah, for sure, man, let's do it. But unfortunately, we couldn't get together while you're here, so we are doing it over Skype or whatever. Mm-hmm. But But yeah, do you want to maybe run through a little bit of that, of how you got connected with the guy in Duck Mountains and the company, etc.?
Let me take a guess here. Like, Joe, you found the only mountain we have in Manitoba. Is that how you got?
I wouldn't call it. You guys call it mountains. That's a foothill out here. No, I was actually at the Sportsman Show in Yorkton last year, and Pat Bergson from Bows and Bullets Outfitters approached Steve and I, and just started talking about his service he had going on. And Steve and I were both very interested in hearing more about it. And just throughout the year, we kept chatting back and forth, and Pat was kind enough to invite us out there to film an episode. Unfortunately, Steve wasn't able to attend. He had some other hunts he was on, but, I mean, Pat's right. It's an opportunity to go deep into the Duck Mountains, stay at a wall tent camp, which was far better than any wall tent camp I've ever stayed at, and then hunt from there every morning on horseback, go back in 5 to 6 miles and hunt some areas in the forest that are mostly untouched. And Pat was so appreciative of the fact that we went out there and hunted with him. And the whole time I'm thinking in my mind, I'm like, this is a hunt of a lifetime. It was just a beautiful experience. Just a gorgeous part of the country. So yeah, it was a pretty, really, really cool experience.
Yeah. And that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's like one of the last like horsebacking, hunting outfits that you can get, I think in Manitoba and probably, well, I think in Manitoba right now, is that true?
In Manitoba, yes. For horseback whitetail, I believe he's the last in North America.
Oh, wow. And
in the Duck Mountains, you're not even really allowed to have camps set up the way he has his set up now. But he's been hunting out of there for 40 years and guiding for over 30 years out of there with his operation and service. So he was grandfathered in. But he has built all of the horse trails back there. I mean, like just miles and endless miles of trails, and all the roads back there he put in himself. He's cut them with a chainsaw.
That's crazy.
He has the stories to prove it. Every corner, every bend, every creek. It blows your mind. It really makes the whole experience. I mean, you could go out there and it would not be the same experience if Pat wasn't there with you.
Man, the depth in that, it would just be, like you said, just great to have that experience in there. And just, some of the stories must have been mind-blowing in there.
Mind-blowing, to say the least. And it was such a cool experience to learn from somebody who has been hunting an area that, focused for 40 years. Like I said, and guiding for 30 years. Just the way he reads the land, and he knows exactly where the migratory paths are through there. And just sitting there, and some days I got lost just watching him and his mannerisms and reading how he was reading the land. It was really special.
Yeah, for sure. Was that one of your first horseback hunts, or have you been on quite a few of them?
That was my first horseback hunt. And I've been on horseback before quite a few times, but I've never actually gone on a horseback hunt. And I can tell you right now, it will not be my last.
Yeah. Can you maybe just touch on a few things that were like a lot different than, you know, your traditional whatever, but like, and maybe some more work that you had to put into the hunt to make it successful with horses?
Yeah. So, it's amazing. I wasn't sure how loud the horses would be. I mean, I've been on horseback in the bush before, but I was blown away by how quiet and silent the horses were when you're actually on them. And you can study your animal while you're riding along as well. Their ears are very perceptive to their surroundings. So you can actually pick deer up sometimes before you would be able to see it with your own eyes, because you see your horse's body language shift. So that part was really cool, but you don't actually hunt all day from the horseback. Like, you're not on your horse from morning till night. What it is you go back in, and there's sections of road. You're only allowed to drive vehicles on designated roadways. So a lot of the Duck Mountains are off limits, basically, to most hunters. You'd never be able to get back in there deep enough to properly hunt it. So what you do is you drive to the end of the road, you stay at camp. Every morning you wake up, like I said, you go about somewhere probably between 5 and 7 miles on horseback. And then you tie your horses up typically and you hunt from there. You have the option of either doing a tree stand or a ground blind. What we decided to do was spot and stalk, which was a lot of fun. We had some snow, so you're just tracking and moving around. But I wouldn't say there's any real disadvantage to hunting with a horse. It's a purely advantage. There wasn't anything. The only thing that did make it tough was my poor camera guy is allergic to horses.
Oh, no way.
Did he just find that out on that hunt, or had he known this for a while?
He didn't know. I don't know how there was a miscommunication. He understood everything about the hunt other than the fact that we were being transported by horses every morning. And I felt so bad for him. I mean, luckily he had a whole bunch of Claritin and whatever medication you need for your allergies. But the first day I turned around and, I mean, he was just swollen up. His eyes were red. Oh. He looked terrible. But he was a trooper. He filmed the whole hunt. Never really complained. Every morning after we jumped off the horses, it was cold enough. It seemed to bring the inflammation, everything down from half an hour of hiking. But I don't know that I would have been man enough to push through it the way he did.
That's wild. So, and it's kind of funny because Chase and I were, while you were up there, we were hunting the east side of the park. So we were maybe just a few kilometers,
stone throw.
A little more than a storm. I wouldn't want to be walking through that bush all the way like you identified, but we're virtually hunting the same park, and now here we are podcasting a couple weeks later, so that's kind of cool to hear. And you were also up there with the hunter chef, Michael Hunter. Is that accurate?
Yes, Michael Hunter. Because when Steve wasn't able to make it, and at the time Eric was still negotiating his contracts, deciding if he was going to be retired from the NHL or not. So I had an opportunity to invite a friend, and Michael and I are old time buddies. We've hunted together a few times back in Ontario. So I contacted him. Luckily he had some availability and he jumped at the opportunity.
Nice. And for people who maybe don't know who Michael is, he's another contentious media figure that Joe has teamed up with here, but Michael was, correct me if I'm wrong, but the chef that was criticized in Toronto, was it for, cooking wild game in his restaurant?
Yeah, it was a wild situation. He has a restaurant called Antler in Toronto. And what they do is they go out and they find farms that basically provide meat as close to wild as you're allowed to serve in Canada. Because you can't actually serve a wild harvested deer in a restaurant, other than I think in Newfoundland you can. but anywhere else you're not allowed to. But they go out and they find these farms where everything's raised as wild as possible, harvested as ethically as possible, and they find all the best ingredients, bring it to his restaurant, and that's what he uses in his recipes. And he actually does go out and forage for his own herbs and mushrooms and things like that, because you're actually allowed to do that. But anyway, so he does all of this, and then one day on his little breakfast or his sandwich board in front of his restaurant, I think the phrase was, "Venison is the new kale." He wrote on his board, and somebody was biking past, saw the picture, posted it on their Facebook, and then somehow within a short window of time, he became the target of this group of these vegan protesters. And every week for 11 months, they were at his door protesting.
Holy man. And it got to the point where he had pulled out a venison leg, correct me if I'm wrong. And
He started butchering it in the window, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I think that turned some people a little sideways. But like you were saying?
Yeah, it was 11 months. Yeah. Oh. It went viral when, like you said, he took a venison, the deer leg, butchered it in the window. I'm pretty sure he cooked it and ate it sitting in the front window as well, in front of them. And he did everything, you're allowed to do that. That's what he does at a restaurant. And the video of that went viral. And then he ended up getting flown down to be on the Joe Rogan podcast. And his restaurant, it was actually probably one of the best things that ever happened to his restaurant. His restaurant went from, being busy. It was always a busy restaurant, but all of a sudden you couldn't get a reservation there for 3 months.
That's wild.
It was a crazy idea. It was great. But he did it all in a very well planned out, I guess, maybe not well planned out, but he did it all in a way that represented hunters very well. That was the butchering the deer in the window was a bit of a roll of the dice, but it paid off well.
That's where our meat comes from though. So that's one way. So we got a couple tasty treats here from Josh McFadden every once in a while, but did Michael cook anything up in camp for you guys?
Oh yeah. The first night after he shot his deer, we had heart and backstrap, and it was delicious. I mean, it was just the traditional heart with onions in the pan, but I don't know how he did it so differently. It's just the heats he cooked at, or I don't know, but I've never had heart tasted that good.
Yeah.
And then, yeah. And then when I shot my deer, he did liver, and he made this prune reduction. It was almost like a jam or a chutney that we had with the liver and the onions as well. And oh my gosh.
I think we could probably sit and talk camp food all day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Never gets old.
Not to talk down about his cooking and all, but there's something about camp that always makes food taste a hell of a lot better too. Just being in camp and having that food.
The camp factor.
Yeah, the camp factor.
Oh, without a doubt. If you're at hunt camp, or especially if you're on a backpacking trip, I mean, you could eat something that you'd normally turn your nose up at in the city. And, you know, if you're in the bush or you're 3 days backpacking on a goat hunt or something, and you get it on the fire,
oh,
it's the best tasting food you've ever had.
That'll change some spirits pretty quick, eh?
Oh, yeah.
So obviously, let's talk about this hunt a little bit more. You're in the bush, you're on the horses. Obviously, through our conversations, we've established that you were successful in hunting. You want to kind of just give us a little breakdown of maybe the couple days you're in there, and then what happened with your, if there's any crazy encounters or what? Take us there.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have to say, I've never seen whitetail act the way that they were acting out there in the Duck Mountains. I'm guessing it's because we were so far removed. I don't know if you guys had the same experience on your trip, but they had recently logged this one section of the woods. So there was quite an open area. And the does and the fawns were coming out into this area to eat, because it's obviously easy foraging for them. But the bucks were just pure zombie mode. They had their noses to the ground and they're just walking the edges of the clearing, sniffing for these does. And I had one buck. I sat there. I got the camera guy to stand still, and we both stood still. It walked up to 18 yards, and we're just standing in the middle of the open. Walks up to 18 yards, looks at us, then puts his nose down, goes back to sniffing, and walked past us at 12 yards. it was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had. He was just rutted right up, though, trying to find himself a doe. But we saw a lot of bucks. We saw a lot of deer. Every day we were out there, I think day one, we saw some like 13 bucks.
Wow.
And we saw a lot of nice deer that if I had been hunting any other section, I don't think I would have been able to keep my safety on. But chatting with Pat before I went out there, he showed me some images of the type of deer they like pulling out of the woods there. And I was doing my best to harvest an animal that you know, did justice and represented the local deer well. So I kept holding off, but it was tough. The deer out there were just beautiful. There was really nice bucks. They're not your typical whitetail. They seem to be a little cagier, but thick, heavy beam, dark chocolate racks on them. It was a beautiful trip. So every day we went out, we were seeing a lot of deer, but there were a lot of younger bucks. But you could just tell they had really strong genetics. So we were trying our best to let them grow. And then finally on day five, which was the last day, I woke up and I told Pat at breakfast, I said, you know, Pat, I've been trying really hard, but I'm ultimately a meat hunter. So something's hitting the ground today. And yeah, we were riding in and yeah, we're getting close to where we were going to tie up our horses. And we came around the corner, and lo and behold, there's this beautiful buck standing in the middle of a meadow, just doing his thing. We weren't sure what he was doing there at first. We figured he had just been bedded down and jumped up when we came around the corner on the horses. So I jumped off the horse, got set up, and was fortunate enough to drop him in his tracks, which is always what you want to do. You
know, nice.
Quick, clean kill. But then after we're sitting there and we're field dressing the buck, and we look up, and a wolf came into 50 yards when we weren't paying attention.
You're kidding.
And it came right in on his tracks. And then we scrambled to try and get our rifle, but mine was too far away, so it took off into the bush. And then as we go back to field dressing the buck, I turn around, and from the other side, a wolf popped its head out of the bush on the other side. Wow. So this buck was getting hunted by a pack of wolves. just before we harvested him. So he's extremely fortunate that he came to his end because of us and not because of those wolves, because wolves are ruthless, as you guys know. So,
oh man, what an encounter. That's a pretty speedy demise for the deer, thankfully.
Yeah, we noticed a lot of bucks and a lot of wolves and coyotes when we were out that way as well, I think.
We're kind of hunted right on the park edge, and still kind of ag land, and the coyotes have a very heavy presence
in that area. Really?
Yeah.
But we saw a decent amount of coyote tracks, but the wolves were far more prevalent.
We had a guy, actually, he was up there a couple weeks before us, and he had shot a deer. And
he was meat hunting.
Yeah, he was meat hunting, I can't remember. It must have been like 15 minutes, half hour or something. They went up there, and there was two coyotes tugging on it already.
Yeah. Had the back leg opened up already. Yeah. So the pressure's on, but also, like, little insider Manitoba intel, I could say we've probably seen more big bucks harvested this year than we have in the past, like, I don't know, 5 years or so, I would say. Yeah,
for sure.
It's been pretty wild. And it's interesting you talk about those chocolate horns, because I could stare at a set of chocolate horns on the wall here that we harvested out of the hills or Duck Mountain there. So it's interesting the genetic makeup of these bucks that roam those hills.
Yeah, stereotype. I think it has a lot to do with, like, the environment they're in there.
Probably the diet, like, or something, eh?
Diet and, like, the lots of that, like, pine and the saps and stuff.
I think it has to be, because we went down to Boggy Creek Taxidermy afterwards.
Oh, yeah.
He had some of the deer that had been harvested in the farmland, and they were almost bone white.
Really?
Yeah, they were this really light blonde racks on most of them. And he said that he sees it all the time. The bucks that come out of the Duck Mountains are a much darker, chocolatey type rack. And then the ones that come from the farmland mostly, they're always a lot lighter, almost that kind of dusty blonde look.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Did you see any elk when you were up there?
No, didn't see any. Do you guys?
We saw a sign, but we didn't really see any elk themselves. Lots of rubs, lots of tracks, but no, we didn't really get on them at all.
Right. We did bump one morning. We bumped a bull, moose. But we never got eyes on him, but we had seen where he was bedded and fresh tracks, and he'd been beating the heck out of some bushes. But I was really hoping we could get eyes on him, because they're just beautiful animals, and it was perfect moose country, but weren't that lucky.
Oh, man, that would have been a cherry on top for sure. And a couple extra species.
Yeah.
It's always nice to see them.
So can we look forward to this kind of the hunt making its way onto the Edge TV show?
Oh, definitely. I wouldn't be surprised if that's probably going to be my highlight hunt of the year. That was one of my more exciting hunts. And it was just everything about it, start to finish, the content we got from all the close encounters with the deer and being horseback. The only thing I know I'm going to get heck for it already is when I'm sitting on that horse, I look like I'm a kid at a little girl's birthday party. stinking pony. My feet were almost dragging on the ground. And I promise you, it's a full-size horse. I'm just a slightly larger than average individual.
I was thinking about bringing that up. How big of a horse do they have up there for you?
I'll send you a picture. That's hilarious. It was pretty funny. They had a lot of laughs. But my horse, her name was Jewel, and she was a trooper. She somehow drew the short straw and had to carry me around all week. But
they probably had a few conversations when they were all saddled up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's so one of the ways to access that is through satellite TV, but is there a way to stream that show as well? Like if you wanted to subscribe somehow?
You can subscribe on My Hunt Fix, and you can get access to our content, but we're actually available through all major, television providers, here in Canada. I mean, you name it, not just satellite TV, but any real, you can call in and get the subscription. We can get added on. It's not a big addition. And we have tons of great content and a lot of great hosts and shows that are filmed up here in Canada. So, I mean, nationwide as well. It's not just located in one province. We're all over the map.
So what's kind of next on the horizon then for the Edge TV? Like, what can we look forward to here? What's anything lined up here in the next few months?
Any big hunts coming up?
Yeah, hunts or fishes.
the hosts, we've filmed most of our content so far. I have one hunt I'm really excited about. I'm going to get over to Vancouver Island and I'm going to do a cougar hunt.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So maybe I'll get end up, you know, going against the firing squad like Steve did for his. But after defending him for that hunt, I've been doing a lot of research on the process. And I've had a few encounters with cougars in the bush before, but I've never gone out and specifically hunted cougar. But I have had cougar meat. It's delicious, and I can't wait to get some in my freezer. So I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to that hunt over on the island.
Yeah, that's sweet. And hey, Joe, while we have you on here too, kind of maybe a question outside of the box, but like I think a lot of people that listen to our podcast and outdoors people always like kind of wonder what it takes to do a TV show. Can you maybe like just run through that quickly? Like how much work does it take in a year to make a year's worth of episodes?
It's surprising how much work it does take. I think you can put as much or as little into it as you want. There's a lot of people that do their own YouTube channels. Right. They go out and they get their handy cams and they self film. And it really depends on the host. And it's surprising the difference it makes the first time you step in front of that camera, especially when you're out in the bush and you're hunting. It does change the way you hunt a little bit. It takes this, there's an adjustment period where you get used to the process. But I mean, for the show, for what we do, it is quite a bit of work. You have a lot of interviews every day. You get back to camp, you're exhausted. You don't want to do anything other than eat and get to bed or figure out your plans for the next day or maybe play a few games of cribbage. But you got to sit down. You got to do your evening recaps. And there's always different parts you have to film. And yeah, it takes quite a bit. But at the same time, it's a labor of love because you're having an absolute blast out there. I grew up watching hunting shows as a kid and dreaming of one day having, you know, that opportunity. And I can't believe that I'm fortunate enough to be sitting here doing it many years later.
That's the dream, man. That's the big time. We can definitely attest to the adjustment period. I think we got one video up on YouTube where we fished for lake trout, and I think we mentioned the body of water 16 times, and then the bait we were using about 21 times. So I can definitely appreciate that. It seems like there's a camera factor there. As soon as that's on you, there's a bit of a learning process to settle into getting back to the basics of who you are and what you want to represent, kind of.
Yeah, I think I did a little bit of digging into it, and then it always seems to be like coming back to like remember who you are, why you're doing it, and what you want to accomplish with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, absolutely. That's the trick. I think a lot of people, it's kind of set up this ideal in their mind of what they're supposed to be as a host, and they may try and pretend to be someone they're not. But the biggest trick is just trying to stay natural and have fun out there.
Yeah, for sure. And you did kind of mention you grew up watching like TV shows, etc. Do you try to mirror yourself to somebody maybe that you watched growing up?
I try not to. A big piece of advice that Steve actually gave me when I came onto the show was that no matter what you do, try and be yourself on the show. Because if you try and be someone else or act inauthentically, it's going to go one of two ways. He said that the audience is either going to react negatively to it, and then you're always going to wonder what it would have been like if you were yourself on camera. And then he said, so that was one negative outcome. And the other negative outcome is if you fake who you are on camera and the audience really loves it, then you're stuck faking who you are for the rest of your career as a hunter as well. So it was very good advice, but it's still difficult trying to figure out who you are, like you said, and stay natural on camera. But I mean, luckily we have great cameramen, we have great editing team, and they put together some phenomenal content. So they somehow even make me look decent on camera.
What would be some of the tricks to get you and Steve in the same shot, in the same frame?
To get Steve and I in the same frame. Well, like I said, him and I haven't hunted together yet. So.
Oh yeah, I guess so. That's true. I do follow Steve on social media also, and I mean, I don't know exact number, but he seems like he's a very slight man.
Yes, he's
but he's a character, man. He's such a character.
He is the type of host that I think every host aspires to be.
Yeah.
He's a natural entertainer, and he is a ton of fun. And I can tell you right now, what you see on camera is the same Steve you're going to get off camera. Like I said, I've been to a few sportsman's shows with him and everything, and he is an absolute riot. He's a blast, and you can tell he is loving every second of it. It's pretty cool.
And we did a little Dr. Google and figured out that Eric Greiba's waterfowl company was Capital Waterfowling Inc. Is that accurate there?
Yes, that is. And I feel terrible for having drawn a blank earlier.
That's
yes,
okay. That's plug it now. What the best duck calls in the industry? Is that accurate?
That's an understatement.
Okay. I've never blown a better duck call before this company that I just Googled.
No, everybody, if you're listening, go check him out. He's phenomenal, Canadian made, and Eric's an awesome individual as well. So can't go wrong there.
What are your opportunities in Squamish there? What do you mainly do? Do you focus on any sort of hunting around there? Or are you usually going out of your backyard to go hunting?
No, I do a lot of local hunting here. Right now, I'm focused pretty heavily on the beautiful coastal ghost known as the blacktail. It is one of the most frustrating animals to hunt. But
the Steve Rinella suck factor.
Yeah, I absolutely love hunting them. I love and hate it at the same time. You got to wait. Like, the worse the weather, the better the hunting conditions are for blacktail. So on the days where it's pouring rain, soggy, fogged in, those are the days you want to get in the bush and go chase them.
Is that your favorite species to hunt, would you say? Or
my favorite species?
Yeah.
I would say it's probably my favorite species to hunt. But at the same time, like I said, it's a very heavy love-hate relationship with blacktail hunting.
There's some pretty rugged terrain around there, too.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'd lose probably 15 to 20 pounds every hunting season going out and hunting blacktail, because you're just going straight up and down these gnarly bluffs. And they like to live in some pretty ugly country. So you gotta get in there and you gotta chase them. You gotta somehow stay quiet too. And at 6'8", 280 pounds, it's not the easiest for me to be quiet in the bush, but somehow I managed to stay relatively successful with the hunts.
Well, I commend you for that, because I know my dad was watching Wild TV and he was watching a blacktail hunt, and he said, I don't understand these guys. They're creeping around in the wet muck up and down the hills for a 90-pound deer. Well, come to Manitoba, you'll shoot a 200-pound deer, and you don't have to go up any hills.
But I know. And you can go around on a horseback.
Yeah, you can go around on a horse. But like you said, it's all about that challenge and that, you know, being connected to that ecosystem that you're a part of. So I get that. Dad, you know, he's like, why take the bow when you can take the rifle?
Old school hunters, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, meat hunter.
I still question my sanity some days when I'm out there. It's like freezing cold in the bush. I'm like, why am I doing this?
That's but, how you know it's a good hunt.
Yeah. Suck factor.
Yeah.
So, Joe, you described to us these amazing hunts and this foraging and some of the great meals that Hunt Chef there put on for you. But if you're having people over to your home, say this weekend, what kind of meal are you going to be whipping up for them to win their hearts on the outdoorsman side of things?
One of the most common intro wild game meals I'll make for friends when I have them over would probably be venison burgers. Just whip up some good, some fresh ground. So I'll cube it up. I always cube my ground and I leave it frozen. And then when I want to serve it, I'll grind it that day. Just mix in a bunch of, onions, various seasonings. My new favorite is the High Mountain Seasonings, their venison rub.
Oh, yeah.
It's just delicious. And I'll mix that in with a little bit of honey and maybe some barbecue sauce and make your patties, throw them on the grill, and then I'll saute up some wild chanterelles or wild pine mushrooms. And you have those on top of a venison burger, and it's a good one to help win some people over for hunting.
So I was going to say, it sounds like maybe the venison burger is more approachable than maybe just a straight cut of meat here, but it really sounds like it's an experience here. You're talking about not just the venison itself, but the chanterelle mushrooms and all the other things that you're putting into it here. It really boils down to experience, it sounds like.
Yeah, no, that's definitely it. Normally, I mean, you're sitting there, and I'll try, and even if they're open to it, I'll be grinding the meat while they're there. Like my friends or family, we still have a lot of company that visits us from Ontario, and it's kind of a new experience to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it just gives you an opportunity to discuss the whole process with them, and they get to see it hands on, and sometimes join in and help out. But yeah, it's the whole process and explaining the process and showing, like we said earlier, it's more than just putting antlers on your wall. It's about bringing people together over a warm meal and sharing all the stories behind it and getting that appreciation for what it takes to put that meat on your table.
Yeah, for sure. And like, that's another thing that I'm going to add on to that statement that you just said, is that I think like we kind of talked about it earlier about how hunting and traditions and stuff are evolving, and we got to do different things to attract different people. And the one thing that we always have in common with a lot of different groups and stuff is food. And just like you're talking about with that, with the vegan side of things, etc., is just like there's ways we can cook food and prepare food that maybe our fathers and our uncles and stuff kind of just butchered. And we've talked about it a million times on this podcast.
Yeah.
You get, you know, a piece of venison that tastes like old boot leather that's dried out, but there's actually ways you can make the stuff taste good. And if you can, you know, cook and use that to strengthen our numbers just by, you know, offering it to your friends and family, I think that goes a long way.
No, definitely. I don't think I've ever had anybody come over for dinner and not enjoy the wild game or not ask for some going home.
Yeah.
They always want, hey, when can I get more of this? And I always, you know, I'll give them a little bit and then I say, go out and get your license and I'll take you in the bush and I'll show you how you can get your own. And I think it's a great driver to get people out once they've been exposed to wild meat and they understand, like you said, you can cook it properly. We've all had those meals when we were younger where you get served the boot leather that's just you can't stomach it. It's terrible. Maybe it tastes rutted up or something. But quite often when you get that gamey flavor out of the meat, it's because you've cooked it to too high of a temperature too fast.
Yeah.
You can't cook wild game meat the same way you cook beef from a store.
Or just mishandled in the processing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You have to prepare it differently. But if you prepare it properly, we've had bucks that when we walked up on them, they just reek. They're rutted right up. But as long as you're diligent with the processing, you won't even taste that in the meat when it's on the table.
Yeah, love that. You've talked about taking out new hunters quite a bit through our conversations here. Mm-hmm. What would you say are like some key ways to A, get them out, and B, get them to really enjoy being out there, and essentially how do you get them to be more mindful out there and just really enjoy the whole experience?
Is it the Sitka blacktail hunt? Is that it?
I would say one big benefit of hunting out here is just the fact that we're in such a beautiful part of the country. You never have a bad hunt because every time you go in the bush, you're just in beautiful country. You're going to have encounters with wildlife of some sort, whether or not, I mean, sometimes or quite often when you're taking your first time hunter out, it's very difficult to get, you know, close in on deer because they're very skittish, but you're going to be seeing eagles. You'll see bear. You'll see, apparently recently we're seeing grizzly like crazy out here. But we have everything in our backyard here. We have rosies. We have mountain goats. Oh. So when you're in these beautiful areas and you got snow-capped mountains around you and you explain to them, you know, this is why we're out here hunting. It's a bad day in the bush is better than your best day in the office, you know? And I think that side of it, and then also kind of trying to check your ego before I take out, like check my ego as a hunter before I take out first timers, and just, you know, telling myself it's just going to be a fun day in the bush and not really putting too much weight on the hunt. Because if you put too much weight on a hunt, it's pretty easy to make the experience less than enjoyable for a first time hunter.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but I got one more question for you before we start wrapping this up. But, and it's, that is not a hunting question. It's going to be back to the football thing. You played for Washington State in college, right?
Yes.
Can you give me like, just like, I don't know. I think it's one of those things that I think Canadians and stuff don't understand how big football is down in the in our neighbors to the south. But can you give me just a little bit of like your experience playing for a school like that and like how you're treated and stuff like that? Like it's pretty much like a professional sport, is it not?
Going down playing at Washington State, it was honestly, I can't even think of how I could begin to describe it. It's unbelievable. It's like a religion. College football, especially. I would say that college football is to the extent where it's actually larger than the NFL down there.
Right.
Because you'll never be an alum, or very few people will ever be an alumni to an NFL team. But there's thousands and thousands and thousands of individuals going through these universities every year, and they become tied to these sports teams. And you go down there, and I mean, we're the first game I ever touched the field on. We were playing, it was a preseason game against Wisconsin, and I think we had 101,000 people in the stands.
Wow.
But yeah, it's an experience unlike anything I have ever had in my life. And coming from a small town here in Squamish, I think we had maybe blown up to 12,000 people before I moved away. And then all of a sudden going to Washington State, and I'm going onto a football field where if it was a small crowd, it'd be maybe 40,000 people. Oh, and that's, again, almost four times the population of my town I grew up in. So it was a big adjustment for me. But again, an amazing experience. The facilities we had available to us were next to none. I'm trying to think of how I could put it into words to really describe what it was like. But it was just an amazing, amazing time in my life. And I'm very fortunate to have been able to experience it.
Yeah, that's cool. And were you the only Canadian on that team, or was there a couple other guys there with you?
No, we did. We had a few other Canadians. Trying to think, two of the guys that were there, Tyson Penser and Johnny Frazzani, were there. I'm sure we had a few other Canadians, and if any of them hear this podcast, they're going to give me heck for not mentioning their names. The states have been getting a lot better of actually drawing from the Canadian pool. They're pulling down a lot more athletes and giving them those opportunities, which is really exciting to see.
Yeah, for sure. And something just came to my mind too, but did you find that like in your professional sports career, you found a lot of people where you could connect with the outdoors and hunting and stuff? Like we did a podcast with Jordan Tutu, and that was one thing that he said that kind of like I didn't really think about. And it was just like he found a lot of connections with his teammates when it came to the outdoors. Was that the same thing with during your career?
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot of guys in the sporting industry, I guess you could call it, that are involved in hunting and fishing as well. And it kept me sane in a lot of ways because your hunting season overlaps, or your football season overlaps so heavily with your hunting season. I wasn't able to get in the bush or to get back home to go hunting. And it's something that affected me in a big way because I'm so passionate about hunting. But, you know, I was fortunate enough to have some friends that would take me out. And I mean, even if it wasn't me cutting a tag, I'd get to be out there with them while they were cutting their tags and stuff. And no, it was a fun time.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's the only thing that kept me out of the CFL was the overlap between hunting season and football season.
Yeah. It's never too late. I'm sure you can get
it. Yeah, I don't think I'd make it past the 1 yard line. The punt return always terrified me. I was like, that's got to be have to be a pretty special person to want to pick that ball up.
Yeah, to be the returner themselves. I mean, I was on special teams a few times and out there for punt return and things like that, but I was actually never the returner. But still,
yeah,
you're out there and it's just a field of human missiles at that point.
Oh man,
it's insane.
Like mm-hmm. And like refined missiles, like that's your life's purpose, right? That's your goal, is to knock that person down. That's wild. I guess my last question here is we're going to be moving on to our Christmas special here, and I'm not sure if you observe Christmas, Joe. Do you?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, I do.
Do you have anything on the old Christmas wish list here for hunting gear? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about next. But just wondering, anything on your list for the new year?
Anything on my list, like an item that I'm looking that I want?
Yeah.
Ooh, what is something? I'm not an overly trying to think of areas. I hunt quite minimalist, but I think I'm going to bug my missus to get me some new boots.
Oh, nice. You got any one in particular eyed up there?
Boots? Yeah. I don't think I have anything. See, that's the tough part for me is, I mean, my feet are size 15, so.
Wow. Oh, wow.
I normally go out there and I try and find the company that actually has my size and then go from there.
We'll put the word out.
Please do. If you find a company and they say, hey, we make size 15s and they're phenomenal boots, I will be all over it.
Maybe we'll try and get you a horse that fits next time too, Al.
Yeah. We need to get Pat of Clydesdale out there.
Yeah, coming from a larger individual standpoint, I always have a hard time trying to find good hunting clothes or hunting clothes that fit or just like some gear that fits in general. What do you have any, say, tips for someone that's above and beyond the normal?
That's range? A little squatchy.
Yeah, squatchy.
Chase is like the Sasquatch of our group.
That's
so.
My handle.
Okay. I wasn't sure if you were dancing around the fact that I'm a giant and you didn't want to say it. I'll well, go out and say it. You don't have to tiptoe around this. It's kind of an elephant in the room. But it's pretty obvious. I would say I was actually really impressed. My gear I ran this year was QU, and they went ahead and they've started running much longer inseams in some of their pants as well. So they have up to a 37-inch inseam in a lot of their pants, which is, for me, I can't tell you how many times as a kid going out hunting, I was out there in flood pants, and you could see the tops of my boots at the bottom of my pants. Oh, yeah. But it's not a good look. But no, now with the new longer inseam, I've been very impressed. And for, you know, I don't have to always count on my gaiters to get me through the day now.
That's awesome. Actually, I had another fellow I was working with who spoke very highly of the Kuyu stuff too. And just the way it fit and their layering systems and how those all kind of fit together and were sized all together and everything like that.
No, but they're really good hunting systems, like you said, layering systems. And for people who, if you're going to be doing a lot of backpacking or hiking, it's really easy to pull layers off and to interchange it all. So,
yeah.
So.
I'm going to have to look into this QU thing a little more because I got a 36 inseam. And generally anything that fits me looks like a pair of parachute pants.
It's a great look, isn't it?
Yeah.
MC Hammer.
It's tough to sneak through the bush with pants like that.
Oh my gosh, it's painful.
I could be speaking out of my butt here, but I think the founder of Sitka moved over to QU and founded that company. But that's, like I said, something I might have to do more research on. But
Is that Jason Hairston?
Jason sounds familiar. Yeah.
I'm not sure if he was found. I'm not sure. I'd have to dig into it too.
Yeah.
Right on. So I guess basically we're not going to take up any more of your time. We kind of, I think, fulfilled a lot of the questions we wanted to ask you. But yeah, for me, thank you very much. First of all, for taking that cold message from the Duck Mountains and agreeing to do a podcast. I think that, just following your Instagram account, if anybody's looking, I would suggest following it. You have a lot of good content. And I just think, like, with Panoramic Outdoors and yourself, we have a lot of similar interests that, just reflecting on them, like this last hour and a bit just flew by because it's all stuff that we believe in and that we are trying to, like, advocate to the outdoor world. So, like I said, thanks again for for coming on our show. And I'll leave it up to you guys, too.
I appreciate you guys having me on the show. Like I told you before, this was I've done a lot of, you know, radio shows or TV interviews, things like that. But this is actually my first podcast. So you guys were delicate with me and I appreciate it. So it was a lot of fun.
Well, yeah, I totally reinforced everything Sheldon just said. And hopefully we can have you back on one day.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, I was going to say, I don't think we're going to let him cross that Manitoba-Saskatchewan border without a wobbly pop or two being introduced into the mix, hopefully, next time.
Don't threaten me with a good time. I'm in.
Okay, Joe, thanks so much, man. You have a good day, and good luck on that hunt coming up, too. Hopefully, you tag out there.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, and all the best for you guys with the rest of your seasons as well.
Right on, man. Are we rolling?
We're rolling.
Oh. So when you have size 15 feet, 6'8", 280 pounds. That's one hell of a guest we just had.
Our largest guest, I would say our biggest guest yet.
He was so big, we had to call him from BC because we couldn't fit him in the house.
What are you trying to say here, man? This is my domicile.
Yeah, sorry.
Joe, we'd have room for you here. Don't worry about chilling.
Yeah.
I don't know if we'd have enough beer for him, though, is my concern. That's one thing I did want to clarify that we will not be buying the beer.
Like, I mean, maybe there's a cost share program or something we can look at here, but yeah, we don't have I don't have a beer for you guys, never mind.
Yeah. Right on. Well, I just like to say thanks again to Joe for coming on. And there's just one more kind of shout out I want to do. We've kind of been in talks with Ecogenix Agricultural Recycling Company out of Saskatchewan, and they sell Quattro boots. They're rubber boots made by Skeller Up, and they started making them in like 1910, and they sent us a pair. Interesting, you got to try them out. Do you want to just give it a quick little quick review?
Yeah, you know what? We got them in the mail there, and I managed to Chase and I went tree chopping with the family there for Christmas, and thought it'd be a great time to just, you know, give them a trial run. And so far, you know, I haven't put them to the full test, but I've been really impressed. If you look online, they kind of look like a muck boot, but they seem a lot more rugged, and like there's a lot more structure to them, which I appreciate, because I know I remember looking at Kevin like he was a psychopath when he was saying he hunts elk in muck boots, and I was like, man, there's no ankle support in those things. How do you do? But like these Quattro boots, they have a bit of support and structure, which I like, and they were still super comfy. So personally, I'm really looking forward to putting them to the test. I know muck boots were on the list for me to get, like something in that line, so I'm really excited to be just I'm hard on gear, so I'm excited to see what these things hold up.
Yeah, for sure. And if you guys are interested in these boots, I mean, I went onto the website and read all the reviews, and I haven't read a bad one. I haven't even read one that didn't get a 5-star. They seem to be working, and they're for like the working class farmers and outdoors people. Like the reviews are saying, the one guy was saying, like, that's all he wears now is these boots, and he wouldn't buy anything else, and he's outside with his cattle every day, no days off kind of idea, you know, cattle farming is.
What one thing I want to reinforce is, like, yeah, the quality is there for sure, but like, the detail to like the comfort in those boots, like I squeezed my foot into that little boot and like just
you
mucked around in there. I was like, these things, like you could spend all day in those, no problem.
Yeah,
it's like a hybrid between like a Croc and like an actual hunting boot. So like, I mean, you got all the comfort of the Croc so far, and That structure and that ruggedness of, you know, like an outdoor boot, which was kind of nice to see.
Yeah, and the one that we got is like a Quattro, I think Extreme it's called. So it's like rated for like minus 60, but they have like uninsulated regular rubber boots as well. But if you want to check them out, go to www.ecogenix.com, ecogenx.com. And if you use our promo code Panoramic, you'll get 15% off of your boot purchase. So if you're looking for some rubber boots for ice fishing or whatever you want this year, at least check it out. It's local, local distributor, and he's starting off. So
I think they're going to be dynamite for ice fishing.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
We'll test that minus 60 out for sure.
Yeah, right on.
And then looking back at Joe here again, just really appreciative of the fact that he was able to connect, and you know, not only that, experience like a truly unique Manitoba whitetail hunt.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, I can't wait till that episode comes out on Wild TV. I know I'm going to try and figure out a way to get at it as quickly as possible here. And hell, maybe we should host a viewing party.
Yeah.
Hey, cool, eh? A couple brewskis, maybe.
Yeah. Maybe Washington State jersey and Toronto Argonauts jersey. And
yeah. A little little mustard, maybe.
A little mustard.
Hey.
Making mustard. Have you... if you guys haven't seen that, that's another thing I might have to mention. Our good buddy Josh just launched a mustard. It's called Make It Mustard, and it's gourmet mustards they basically you make at home. It's an unreal. They got some great recipes and stuff that you can check out.
Yeah, and you can pair it. He's got recipes to pair it with like every meat and like all kinds of meals and stuff like that too. So
yeah.
If you think mustard was just for hot dogs, you're wrong.
very wrong.
I'm excited. He's got like some pretty, like, I saw he was like, there was like a whiskey mustard you can make.
Yeah.
And like a gin mustard or something. Yeah. Like
and tequila. I think there's a tequila one.
Yeah,
there.
That's, yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Tequila lime or something.
Josh is a real Renaissance guy, but it seems like he's like, he's found his, there's a real, I think he's onto something here with this mustard.
Yeah. I think so too. And the thing is, like, everyone that I've talked to, I'm like, oh yeah, like this mustard, you should check this out. And they're like, mustard for what? Like Jay said, it goes on hot dogs. But like, you can do so much stuff with it.
Yeah,
like, so, especially gourmet mustard.
Oh, dude, man, like that one pork roast crust he made, or like the crust for the pork roast he made, like that just looks unbelievable.
Yeah,
Josh is a special cook, but like, I mean, there's no reason why you can't cook at a level that Josh might consider cooking at.
Yeah. So if you are listening to this podcast, go to that website, www.makeitmustard.com.
We got a promo code for that one too.
Promo code PANO15 for 15% off at checkout. So there.
Check it out.
That another local company, support local.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
Be a great gift to talk
to. Imagine a stocking stuffer stuff.
Yeah.
I think that'd be perfect.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And not only that, but like, I think it'd be just cool, especially this time of the year, to like, when you have people over, friends, family, and be like, here, check this out. I made this myself.
Yeah.
Homemade.
Yeah.
No one really needs to know. I mean, then you elaborate after.
And yeah.
Like, oh, actually, I got it from here. Check this out.
Yeah, that's a really great idea.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll push your repertoire a little too, eh? Cooking wise?
Yeah, exactly.
I can only hope.
It's not just hot dogs and cheese whiz, eh?
Well, thanks for listening, everyone, and I hope you enjoyed the episode as much as we did. Again, don't forget to follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook. And Dell did us a big favor there that one time, calling us out and saying, you know, one thing they could do that really help us out is rate us and leave a comment. You know, that goes a long way in helping promote our product. So with that being said, enjoy your evening, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.